ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Melissa Eggleston, UX designer and content strategist, and also an author of The Zombie Business Cure. We're going to talk about building a unique identity for your software business today. This episode is brought to you by Refine AI, a tool for measuring the emotional appeal and engagement of your video ads. This simple solution lets you automatically test your videos with real people and get insights back in real time. Schedule a demo at refineai.com/UIbreakfast and receive 20% off your first year if you decide to sign up. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for making the time. We are thrilled to have you here.
Thank you.
How about we start with a short Blitz questionnaire so that we can learn where you come from, and then we can dive into the main topic.
That sounds great.
Fantastic. So question number one is, what do you do for a living?
So I am a UX professional, and I spend about half my time doing UX research and design, and the other, well, maybe it's more like 60-40, the other 40% doing content strategy. I spend 3 days a week at Lenovo as a user researcher there for their global websites, and the other two I am with my own clients.
Can you tell us a bit more about your background? Where do you come from, and what did you do before?
Sure. So I basically, in my 20s, ran around a lot trying to figure out what I should be doing with my life. And I was a certified financial planner, and I taught English as a second language for a few years. And ultimately went back to graduate school for journalism. And that's where I learned, I was trained as both an economics reporter as well as I learned what was called multimedia design back then. It's now called UX design. And came out of there and was a communication specialist at a university for about 4 years, where I did everything from run around shooting videos to fussing with web layouts to doing a lot of interviews and focus groups and kind of a hodgepodge. From there, moved into content strategy more because I realized I liked the planning and the strategy more than the actual writing and doing blog posts and that sort of thing. And then from there, in order to be a good content strategist, I just got more and more into research and started doing more and more user research and just incorporating it into my projects. And so I found myself now doing more UX design because after you do the research, people then go, well, what should I do? So you start ending up designing as well. So,
right, that's quite a unique blend of skills, and I think that makes you really stand out among other professionals.
Well, you know, it really was grad school. Like, I learned all of these different skills in grad school. I was taking graphic design, I took writing, you know, I was taking video, I was taking UX design. I was, I don't know, it was a whirlwind 2 years, best 2 years, just great. So it set me up well to be able to do a lot of things.
These days, what does your typical work day look like?
Let's see. So when I'm working as a user researcher at Lenovo, my typical workday is coming in and maybe checking in on some usability tests that I've been running, typically with like remote participants. So I might be watching videos. Today I've been watching different videos of how people were using a certain proposed design in an Envision prototype. And so I'll spend some time doing that. I'll spend some time putting together the results summary. I might spend some time today putting together a research plan for another thing we want to be testing on our global websites. So I do a lot of evaluative testing here at Lenovo. And on my days when I'm not here, I'm currently working on redesigning some medical school UI software that a lot of medical students use throughout the world. Working on the redesign of that and working really closely with the product manager and the developer to have them execute my designs and not have it get lost in development at some point. I have noticed sometimes, developers have their own ideas, so it's about working with a team and helping them understand, like, why this is important to the users for it to be done this way. So I'll be working on that, for example, this week, as well as a nonprofit client I have will be doing some content strategy and doing some participatory design for some templates for her website.
Great. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
I love the research. I could interview people all day long, every day, and be happy. I find watching user videos fascinating. I love usability testing. I love broad interviews where we can kind of, I can follow where the participant goes versus trying to get like really specific questions answered. Sometimes it's just great to have it be open-ended. I just really enjoy being around people and understanding their motivations, what makes them tick. So that is hands down my favorite part of UX. I also really like teaching as well. I teach Intro to UX for Girl Develop It, which is a wonderful organization. So I really enjoy that. What do I like least? I think I like least invoicing people. I just want to do UX work. I want to do the design and the research. I don't particularly love the aspects of running a business, which I just kind of stumbled into when I started freelancing, and it kind of just kept building on itself. So, yes, don't make me invoice people, please.
How about receiving money, actually, if you didn't have to invoice? I find it a little bit therapeutic because you get, you know, rewarded for your work.
Well, it's nice when you get the checks, for sure. I just don't like taking time away from design and research to create an invoice and send it off and track my time and that kind of thing. I just find that it just is like a time suck for something that I'm not very interested in. So I probably need to just hire a virtual assistant to help me out with that.
That's right. What is your next
big
thing?
Well, I've been exploring, just finished the book not that long ago, and I've spent most of this year talking with people about identity and brand and marketing and UX. And I've been starting to explore this idea of trauma-informed websites. And what would it mean, especially for sites related to healthcare, if they were trauma-informed? That's a really hot topic in the health world, at least here in the U.S. And how do we apply that to a website? Because I think a great website is like a great conversation, and it's friendly, and it's human, and it makes somebody feel positive and like they want to continue the relationship with you. And if you're not trauma-informed and you're dealing with people who've been through some kind of trauma, whether that be a trauma such as domestic violence or some kind of natural disaster, it's not going to be a positive experience for them if you're not trauma-informed.
That's a very sensitive and also a very interesting direction. Did you find already that there are some good resources on this topic?
That is. I'm starting to create some of those resources. It happened. I was talking to a friend of mine who she's really a trauma educator, and she spends a lot of time training nurses and other people in the medical profession on how can they be more mindful when they're asking questions of somebody who has a traumatic history. And we were talking, and I said, well, it feels like websites should be like this too. And we both were really talking about that websites should also not overwhelm people and should be explaining why they're asking the information they're asking and that sort of thing. And so we've just been trying to apply this idea to the realm of websites. So we're kind of the first people talking about it as far as I know. But I'm starting to get calls from different people. I had a call from somebody in Canada who was like, we want to make our website trauma-informed. They do, I think it's a safety on campus at a university up there. And I was really excited that we're starting to have this conversation.
That's a wonderful new direction. I'm so happy that you found a niche that's both, you know, UX related and, you know, has social impact to an extent.
I know. Isn't that ideal? That's what I love about UX. There's many ways we can apply it for good.
So let's go back to our main topic, which is building a unique identity for your company. And the book that you wrote is called The Zombie Business Cure, and I'm just super curious what inspired you to write it. I know we see identical twins almost in the field of software, for sure, all the time when it comes to UX, when it comes to website design, but what inspired you to write this book together with your co-author?
So we decided to write the book because we were in agreement on how people should be approaching their communication, whether that be through website or software or whatever. And I felt like I was repeating the same thing over and over to clients. So clients come to me and they come at a very tactical level. And from the content world, they'll come and they'll say, I'm not sure which channels we're supposed to be on. What should we be doing? And oftentimes the problem is bigger than that. The problem is actually one of identity and core values and branding and that sort of thing. So I think it's easy to get caught up in tactics and forget about the bigger strategy of who you are and who your audience is and what goals are you both trying to achieve. And so I spent a lot of time backing people into that. So finally I was like, we're just going to write this down and then it can go out to a much broader audience and we can talk about it. And we've had a good experience and it seems to resonate with people.
Can you give us a brief insight what the book is about? What kind of recommendations do you give people? Is that regarding the visuals, regarding the communication, or everything altogether?
So the book focuses mostly on content strategy, but that includes both the visuals and text as well, like copy, right? Because the core of your identity as a company is really your core beliefs. And it's, you know, who you are, how you talk, what you look like, how you behave. It's all of that. It's both the visual communication as well as the verbal communication. And then, of course, the nonverbal communication as well. So we talk about how all these things kind of set your foundation as a company and then also should be reflected in your products and in your website and that sort of thing so that people can see, you know, who are you authentically and, you know, are you the right company for me to be working with?
That's wonderful. How can people, let's say a team of co-founders decides to build a new product and they kind of know what they want to build. They have a vision for their company, but how do they translate it to their language? How do they make it clear to their users?
Well, first off, I think especially if you've got a startup, you're sitting down with your co-founders, and you're figuring out, like, what are our values and what is most important to us and how does this product reflect that, right? What are our values? And there's companies that do this. You know, Buffer is an example of a company that really values transparency. So they have tons of information they provide online about their financials, about the decisions they make, even when they have to lay off people, taking responsibility for their actions and that sort of thing. And they've done that from the beginning. They've said, we want to be really transparent, and this is kind of what we're about as a company. I think for founders to get really clear on, like, who they are and what they're about, and then it's about saying, okay, how do we put this in the language that our users will understand? And so you figure that out by doing user research, right, in your target audience. What words do they use to describe the things that you're talking about? When we were working on our book, one of the first things we did was we had focus groups with different people, both communication professionals as well as just regular old people, and we would ask them questions of, like, well, how do you define identity? How do you define brand? And what do you think mindfulness means? And a lot of the concepts we talk about in the book. So figuring out, you know, what language they were using so then it would make sense when we were creating our book for them. It's the same for software or any other product.
Is there any common flaws? I mean, you called your book about zombies. So definitely you had a great counter example to what is the ideal picture. And you told you're saying that most of the businesses look like zombies. What exactly are they doing wrong?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the reason we use the kind of the bad example of zombies is that zombies tend to be very similar to each other. If I asked everybody who's listening to this podcast right now to, like, stand up and act like a zombie, people would generally act the same. People would slump over and start moaning and maybe put their arms kind of in awkward positions and that sort of thing. And sometimes I have people do this when I speak in person, and it's really funny because everybody looks the same. So there's this real sea of sameness about zombies. They also tend to be really disheveled, just like a bad website. You know, zombies tend to have ripped clothing, and they are very confused. They don't even know who they are half the time or what exactly happened. And websites companies can feel like that too, where it's not clear, like, who they are and what they're about. On the opposite side, when you're, like, fully human, when you're, like, fully authentically yourself as a company, as a person, you are fully embodied. And that was the word my co-author kept using. She kept using the word embodied. You're, like, fully you. You're just totally putting yourself out there and your values, and you're embodied. And I just said, gosh, you're really making me think of zombies. Every time you say embodied, Julie. And eventually we were like, well, that actually kind of works because zombies are terrible communicators. And that's what we see with different software companies, and that's what we see in other kinds of businesses as well.
And you, by naming your book this way, you just actually followed your own advice to an extent, because you didn't name your book How to Build a Unique Identity. That's a very blunt name that I prepared for this episode. Maybe I'm going to change it afterwards. But you named it something that would stand out.
Yeah, we did. It encapsulated what was most important to us. And yeah, zombies, it wasn't just a marketing gimmick. It really made sense to us. And we really want people to stand out and be themselves and be human. Because basically zombies repel people. And when companies act like zombies, it's just a big turnoff. Because people aren't sure who you are or what you really stand for. And sometimes they'll continue down a path with you and then go, oh, this isn't what I thought it was. And to me, the internet, the whole like marketplace at large is a big dating game. We are out there looking for the products and services that resonate with us, that make sense to us, that reflect our own identity. We're reflecting each other. And so, you know, whether you're married or partnered or not, you're always going to be dating and looking for the things that work well for you and don't work well for you. And the sooner you can figure that out, the better. And when one company is trying a lot to look like another company, it's hard for me to distinguish them, and I can't tell if you're the right one for me or not. And that is a big problem, I think.
Yes, absolutely, definitely. I want to touch on the subject of branding these days, because we just a couple days received this wonderful announcement about Dropbox redesign as a great example of branding done, you know, independently, like independent of the company itself. We just had a lot of discussions with our friends about it. But how do you go about building an original, unusual identity, but not standing out as silly or crazy or something like that? How do you build trust and creativity at the same time in your brand?
That's a good question. So I think first it's about getting real about who you are. So too often I see companies who want to call themselves innovative, and they're not innovative. They're not particularly innovative. They just want to use that word. Or they'll say, you know, we're really customer-centric, and you send them an email and you won't get a response. So I think first it's about being really, you know, taking a hard look at yourself and going, what are we really good at and what are we not good at? You know, there's a company here in my area in Raleigh, and they're videographers, and they've been doing it for like 25 years, and they do a lot of videos for corporations and that sort of thing. But they aren't trying to be like the hip videographers. So when you go to their website, it says something like, we're great videographers with really boring hair. You know, like they're not fancy guys, they're not hipsters from New York, they are just regular old guys who know how to shoot video really well. And that's their identity. I don't think it's particularly hard to stand out, but I think it's hard at times to take inventory about who you really are. And sometimes you can do that through talking to customers and seeing how customers perceive you and doing some research that way. But your employees are often the ones who can tell you who you really are. And maybe if you're not your best self, you start to put a vision out there of, okay, this is our best self and this is where we're going to head towards. And then we're going to put that out into the world.
Absolutely. And it goes back as far as to the business strategy itself. I totally don't recall which book that was, but there were a number of inspiring examples. For example, a huge company that does heavy metal production, I don't know, aluminum, I think, and they focused on safety as number one priority, and all other business goals aligned to that, and they turned to thriving from a crisis, and also some airlines making their top priority to fly off, take off the ground on time, and so on and so forth. And you can make that front and center your marketing as well.
Absolutely, yeah. If you can pick one thing, I mean, often what I bump into a lot when I ask executives of a company, well, what do you want to be known for? They come up with a list of 10 things. People can't remember 10 things. People can't remember 4 things. People need to be able to remember like one main thing about you. You're the company that does blank. You're the company who, as you said, focuses on safety. You're the airline that always gets you off the ground right on time, that sort of thing. So that's very repeatable. And you're absolutely right that communication strategy is all mixed up with business strategy, and sometimes one can influence the other in a tremendous way and make it successful or not.
Can you give us some, since most of our listeners are in the software industry, I would love to hear some stories, if you have them, how that was successfully translated in the business of software.
In the business of software. So I think that the biggest one would probably be Buffer and its transparency. You know, you can see how much money Buffer is making right now because they have a dashboard that's available. And they do, I believe it's social media software, help people with their scheduling and that sort of thing. And they've just been really transparent in their customer service, in how they've been growing as a company, in their pricing, everything like that. And I think that's a good model for us to follow. You know, transparency builds trust, right? When people understand what's going on and why you're making the decisions you're doing, why you're adding a feature or losing a feature, why are you changing things, why are you laying off people, people then are able to build trust with you, and then you can have a respectful relationship that's that's successful.
Absolutely. I think one great example of the same is Bayer Metrics. They've been transparent from day one of their company, Josh Pickford, the founder, and they also have a dashboard that actually has their own business metrics in it, and I think some other businesses as well.
Yeah, I love that kind of thing. I think there's another example that comes to mind, and it's Indiegogo. So Indiegogo, for people who don't know who are listening, is like a crowdfunding platform that's quite popular over here in the United States. And it is worldwide, and you know their communication strategy, their UX work, and their business strategy are very aligned. And I had this interesting interview with their UX director, Aga Boyko, and she was talking about how they were updating their company personas. So they realized that they had some personas, and it had been a couple of years, and it was time for them to be updated and that sort of thing. And she took a really broad approach to doing this research. So they didn't just go and start asking people, so tell me how you used Indiegogo. You know, how was that experience for you? And what did you do? Blah, blah, blah. They just really were like, let's go meet these people and understand their motivations and talk about things much more broad. And so they would hear the entire story from their customers of why they decided to start an Indiegogo campaign, whether it was funded successfully or not, blah, 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 blah. And then, importantly, what they did after it was successful for those who were able to fund. And what they learned was that a lot of times people, you know, do a campaign on Indiegogo or maybe one of its competitors like Kickstarter, and they learn that the people get the money and they don't actually know how to execute. They don't actually know how to take the product to market that they've just been funded to create, and so they feel pretty lost. And it actually has caused Indiegogo to change their business model because the UX director went back with her team and explained to the executives, look, people don't know exactly what to do once they get funded. And we could be a real partner. So they have now shifted from a crowdfunding platform to just raise money to a partner in all aspects of fundraising and getting your product to market. And I just think it's amazing how UX research can influence business strategy. And, of course, then they're communicating about that, right? If you go to their website now, you'll see the differences between their website and what they're offering. And, for instance, if you go over to one of their competitors' websites and what they're offering, it's much broader and it's communicated really well.
That's a wonderful case study, indeed. I really didn't know that they offer some kind of partnership for the people who run campaigns there.
I know. It's still pretty new. we caught them right after they'd made this change for the book. So I was interviewing with them about it last fall. So they're still getting the word out, and they're still trying to transfer themselves, right? Transform from, oh, that's the crowdfunding company, to, hey, we're a partner for you to bring things to market. So they're working on how do we shift this other model we've got going on.
In the world of visual design, I struggle with that a lot because I have multiple clients coming to me and I have trouble inventing, you know, different solutions for them, because the more I work, the more I see that there is almost just one effective solution to a single problem, and the companies face very similar problems, at least SaaS companies and web applications. And really, in terms of visual design, there is not much choice. You can make an identity with green buttons, with blue buttons, or purple buttons, and that's about, oh, maybe orange buttons too, right?
Yeah.
In that world of similar colors, how do you stand out visually?
It's a great question. So you've got to stand out actually with the content, you know, and that could be an infographic, it could be a video, it could be, you know, other imagery on the site, but we know people come to websites and certain industries, businesses, with mental models of what they expect to see there. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't ever deviate from them, but catching people off guard and surprising them typically doesn't help. So when I'm working with clients, I'm often like, look, we're not going to get crazy with the navigation. We're not going to get crazy about where we put the search. You know, we're not going to get crazy on, you know, making this button some wacko color that nobody would actually click on because it's an odd color and it's going to give somebody that pause of going, whoa, why'd they do that? That's weird. What we need them to do often is like pull in real experts in creating really interesting content that, you know, obviously can be communicated visually. And really, that's how you stand out. Because people don't come to websites for the interaction design. They don't come for the navigation. They come to do a task. They come to check out some cool content. For instance, if they want to be entertained or trying to get something done. So I think it's about working really closely, the UXers, with the content people to come up with a way to be dynamic visually without making it hard to use the website itself.
This is wonderful. You just spelled out my entire strategy, you know, like in work and life. I hate to be creative with stuff, and I really am a conservative UX designer. Just as you said, and number two is, you know, content definitely trumps design in some cases.
Yeah, well, I mean, ideally it would be done, I think, together. So there's a movement called Content First, which is mm-hmm. which is a reaction to what I'm sure many of your listeners have experienced of, you're kind of building the website, and then the content gets, like, chucked in at the end. It just gets, like, thrown into the design, and it often doesn't work very well. And the cases where I've literally sat next to the visual designer and said, okay, try this headline. Let's see how this works. Okay, that doesn't work. Let's adjust this copy a little bit. Okay, this looks like a wall of words. We need to break up these paragraphs. And really sat next to the designer as we, like, looked at the layout together. That's where we got the best work, like doing it simultaneously, not doing content first or content last, but like simultaneously working together and iterating so that the page can look really beautiful and also not have things like word orphans or have a wall of words or things that we know just turn people off in terms of content.
What is your take? This is a, you know, aching question for me, because sometimes and often branding is delegated to agencies which call themselves creative, while the UX stays in-house or is delegated to another UX person. And that branding and UX, they completely disagree with each other. What do you think of branding as a separate activity?
So I think in the very best companies, they actually work very closely together. So at Indiegogo, the marketing and branding people work extremely closely with the UX team. At Charles Schwab, another incredibly successful company, they absolutely work hand in hand with marketing, branding people, their UX folks. They are working as a team. And, you know, right now here at Lenovo, we have the marketing, branding folks have hired an outside agency who have been coming with some really innovative ideas, and we are testing them before any of them get implemented on our site. We are testing them both with Lenovo customers, with non-Lenovo customers, and really testing that content, not only to make sure that it's usable in some of the different unique navigation and creative things they've come up with, but also making sure that it makes sense in terms of branding and who they think Lenovo is, and that it's the direction we want to head. So this is
wonderful.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's really working really closely together to say, okay, marketing, branding folks, who are you trying to reach? Let's put it in front of people before it gets on our website. Let's put it in front of people early in the process. Before we spend $500,000 doing this, let's spend $10,000 doing this. And it's really been great to get that feedback, because then it gives the marketing branding folks more confidence moving forward that they're on the right track. I mean, the worst thing you can do is beta test on your users, right? You come up with a great idea and you just throw it out on your website or your software, and like nothing's been tested ahead of time. That's just a recipe for problems and a bunch of rework. And we don't want marketing and branding people have to rework either. So we want them to be creative, but we want to test and make sure that they aren't also just creating a bunch of confusion for the users.
I want to go back to the topic of interviewing potential customers or customers, since you mentioned you love interviews. And I know not everyone, including myself, loves that for sure. So what are your favorite tips for fishing out that important information, those insights, those emotions, the words that can really contribute to the brand, as opposed to, you know, some blunt, unprofessional interviews?
Yeah. So if interviewing is not your thing, you know, as a UXer, I feel like research is part of your job. You know, it may not be your full job, but it's going to be part of your job. So the more we practice interviewing, the easier it seems to get. Learning to do things like not lead people in their answers and asking just very general things like, well, tell me more about that and why. This whole idea of asking five whys that I think originated with IDEO, perhaps, where you say, why? Well, why? Explain to me why that happened. And they give you more of an answer and you say, well, why? And you just continue to ask them to open up and tell you more and just kind of nudge them. You'd be amazed at what people will tell you. Also, the use of silence. I notice that people who are newer to interviewing tend to talk a ton. And a great interviewer is actually pretty quiet and really lets silence hang in the air and lets the person continue to talk. And that is stuff that comes from practice and being comfortable with silence. There's a great book called Interviewing Users by Tomer Sharon that I recommend to people who are, you know, want some more tips and want to kind of improve their interviewing skills. But the more you do it, the more comfortable you are. And they are the star of the show. Your interviewee is the star of the show. They have information. They are the expert. It is all about them and letting them feel like that, letting them feel like they are important and what they have to share is important. Even if they take you off into the weeds and you go, oh my gosh, we're never going to get back on track. Over time, you will learn how to get people back on track and just really have that genuine interest in what people's experience is, both with your website and in general, and just trying to live their life and do what they want to do.
This is some great advice. Next question I have is how to be flexible over time while remaining consistent to your original direction.
Do you mean in your career?
Probably in the corporate, in the company's brand.
Oh, I get what you're saying. Okay. Yeah, so it's okay to have a vision of where you want to head, and that's good, right? So ultimately what we all want to be as a company, we want to be like our best self. We want to put our best foot forward. And we may, you know, look at our values and we may look and say, this is what's most important to us. And, we're still kind of acting kind of zombie-ish because we're not actually living out our values really well. We know we want to be innovative. We know we want to do this sort of thing. How do we get there, right? So it's all about then closing that gap from, like, where we are current state to the vision of where we want to be. And you can communicate where you want to be to some degree, but it's when you communicate way far away from who you truly are that it doesn't work. So you kind of got to move people along with you. Radical changes tend to turn off people who liked you the way you were, right? It tends to confuse people who aren't sure what's going on. And then it may resonate with new people. But then the new people, you may have lost some of the old people. And so I think it's about pushing back in terms of the radical redesign, whether it be of a website or a company. And going more for an iterative route of, I mean, Dropbox is an example. I mean, I haven't gotten to look at it more closely since it just happened, but this is a radical change they're doing, and people are having strong reactions to it. And I'll be curious to see in the long run whether that works out for them or not.
It's interesting if whether they're going to listen to the feedback or not, because from the user's perspective, it's pretty transparent that they should be trustworthy business software, not something wild and creative like they want to seem.
Yeah. And it is really interesting. I'll be curious also to see how that plays out. I think it's good to evolve, but it's nice to evolve in stages over time versus jarring people, which is, I think, what they've done.
Right. Melissa, for other resources beyond your book, where can people read on the topic of branding, of creating a great, unique identity online?
Let's see. Online. So
maybe some of your favorite resources, blogs, okay. Other books.
Yeah, I was just thinking. So one person I really do like a lot is Anne Handley. And she is somebody who has said something that I love, where she says, if we took the logo off your website and took the logo off a competitor's website, would I be able to tell who is who? And I think that is really common in terms of the copywriting that companies tend to do when they copy each other, and the style and the tone and voice and that sort of thing. And she's written a book called Everybody Writes, which is more, you know, geared towards writers, but she's got a lot of good information online, so I would suggest checking out Anne Handley, and also Seth Godin. You know, he is like the marketing guru. Who, you kind of can't go wrong reading one of his books related to identity and standing out and branding and that sort of thing.
Seth is very, very high level, but at the same time, it's very inspiring and translatable to daily life. I really love the way he writes.
Yeah, he's very clear. He's very concise. I like his blog because it's super short. He writes like 3 sentences sometimes. So that's a great way to kind of keep up with things in the marketing world and that sort of thing. I really think a lot of it has to do with self-reflection, though, and has a lot of due to coming down to your core values, starting with why are we doing this? What is our purpose? What is our mission? And getting really clear on the foundational aspects and not getting caught up in some of the tactical things.
Absolutely. Melissa, As we're wrapping up today's episode, where can people find your work online and, you know, tune in, subscribe, follow you?
Yeah. So you can find me online. My website is melissaegg.com. And there you can find me. You know, I'll be writing about trauma-informed websites, and I try to get out a blog post once a month. But you can also, I like to be on Twitter a lot. I tend to be there a lot. It's @Melissa_Egg. And so I'd love to interact with anybody who wants to discuss a little bit more about identity and brand and UX, because it's all interrelated. They're not siloed, and they all need to work together.
I love your insight that they so much correlate with what I think about design and strategy. I'm so happy to have you today, and thanks for sharing your insight.
Thanks so much for having me. This has been really fun.
Thank you, and have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.